We are back, kicking off 2021 Connecticut Today for Monday, January 4th. Quinnipiac University journalism professor Rich Handley joined us in the 3 o'clock hour, also to talk about local sports and the death of a gentleman considered by some to be the greatest athlete ever to come out of Connecticut. We gave you a portion of Governor Ned Lamont's latest coronavirus update in the 4 o'clock hour. And I had a notion or two listening to one of our newscasts about what President-elect Joe Biden said about changing America. That's a drumbeat that I too often hear, and I don't think it makes any sense.
Georgia is definitely on the mind of the political world with two Senate runoff elections tomorrow that will determine which party will control the Senate. President Trump will visit Georgia later today supporting the Republicans. President-elect Joe Biden put things this way for the Democrats.
And now we need you to vote again in record numbers, to make your voices heard again and again, to change Georgia, to change America again.
Got something to say?
Give Paul a call.
203-333-9422. Connecticut Today with Paul Pacelli.
You know, I'm listening to Biden there. Number one, slurring words again. This is going to be a fun term in the White House. I love when Democrats get out there and they always say, we want to change America. Change it to what? What the hell do you want to change? We're going to change America. Change it from what to what? Man, so many people in this country, on both sides of the aisle, but predominantly on the Democratic side, they're constantly angry. We're going to change America. Change it what? 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 You're going to drastically change the country that millions of people would come here to at the drop of a hat? I love how people on the left constantly bitch and moan about this country, and yet there are people from south of the border trying constantly to sneak in here. People coming here for educational opportunities, work opportunities, green cards. How many thousands of people do we make permanent citizens every year? Yes, the most racist country in the world. I had a little chat with somebody online one night who jumped on to one of my strings on Facebook. Well, you know, this racist country traditionally hasn't let it was a typical Democratic left-leaning bullcrap. This country doesn't allow enough immigration. I said, excuse me. And I pulled up some government figures. I said, do you realize something on the order of 80 to 90 million people in this country, almost one third of the country, has direct ties to recent immigration? Do you understand? Do you even think before you talk sometimes about this country? It's mind numbing how stupid people are. Once again, I say this all the time, and if you want to say that I'm categorizing people by race, well, you know, listen, you got to look at pictures. Whenever you see these protests of how awful America is, right? Now, you know what I'm talking about. Whatever it is, racism, police, business, Antifa, whatever, who do you hardly ever see at those protests? Think about it. You can see a bunch of, white, privileged suburban stooges, especially these Antifa protests that go on in Portland and Seattle and New York. Who do you hardly, I'm not saying never, but who do you hardly ever see there? Oh, I don't know, the people that come here and kiss the blacktop when they get off of the plane to get here. You know what I'm talking about, the hard-working immigrants that come to this country. Name it. Indian, Pakistani, Iraqi, Lebanese, Chinese, Korean, Taiwanese, people that come from all corners of the world to come here. Right? They come here. They kiss the ground when they get here. But yet you have these protests, and I'm not against protests. God bless people. Do it peaceably. Do it without hurting anybody. Have a blast. But and I'm not saying you shouldn't protest. I'm not saying that. There are a lot of things well worth protesting, but this mantra that is always carried primarily by the left, we're going to change America. Change it to what? Exactly. Change it to what? You want to be more like the big cities where crime is out of control. Murder rates are going crazy in some of these cities. It is just mind-numbing when I hear Biden there at the bottom of the hour slurring his way, saying, we're going to change the country. Oh, just how, I don't know what the word is, how close-minded a lot of people are on the left. Now, on that break, I noticed I had a response to a Facebook string that I was chatting with someone that I used to work with. And we were discussing Trump and the Lincoln Project and all that. And this is how myopic some people have become, particularly on the left. It's on the right, too, but it's on the left more often because they just don't want to. If you don't fit their set of predetermined things you should say, then what you do on social media, which I try not to do with people I disagree with, is you denigrate them. So I'm talking with this person. And this person's, I guess it's her brother. I'm not really sure. This person says, this Paul Pacelli, friend of yours? And he puts the emoji for somebody vomiting. And this friend of mine, to her credit, said, former coworker, good guy, we disagree on Trump. Okay, and that's, you know, you can disagree. To which I guess this guy says, I wouldn't be able to have a civil conversation with anyone who thinks Trump is okay. Okay. And I just responded to him, I'm just crushed. But I actually have wonderful conversations all day with people who disagree with me. and you know, there was a college professor. I want to say I read this about 10 or 12 years ago. I want to say the professor was at a California school, USC, UCLA, you know, Cal Davis, somewhere out there. It was a psychology professor. And again, like I said, this was at least 8 years ago, probably 10 or 12 years ago. And he was starting to notice trends of political discourse amongst his students, among faculty. And he did this study, and I forgot exactly how he did this. But he set up a study comparing what he said were the tendencies of those on the right and those on the left, you know, liberals and conservatives. And he said he found at the end of this study, in analyzing the way that people disagreed about stuff, two things he found out. One, he said, is there is one aspect of both ends of the political spectrum that's consistent, that Democrats and Republicans, liberals and conservatives, tend to be very sometimes rigid about how they view things. In other words, they're very strong in their convictions. I'm like, well, yeah, that makes sense. But what he also found out as a corollary to that, he said that, but when, I'm going to try to remember how exactly he put this, I'm kind of paraphrasing here, but when both sides debated, he found the conservatives were far more willing to engage in real debate about things without name calling. I think he said, you know, a conservative will debate you for hours, citing the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, or something. He said, where those on the left tend to, after just a short time, say, "That's it, I'm done, I'm out." And I've got a couple of friends of mine, again, dear friends of mine, that I know there are certain hot buttons of them, and I love this as a study of human behavior. The consistently, if you push them a little bit on an issue and say, well, I really don't, I kind of see that the other way, don't you think? And the moment you engage on them and that level, they say, that's it, I'm done. No, that's it, done. Which, to me, goes back to a problem that is not just about me as a talk show host or anything. It's about a problem in society, and I've talked about this all the time, and we see this on college campuses. What happens when you get a conservative speaker that comes into a liberal campus. There are, it's calmed down a little bit, but there are these efforts in these campuses to oftentimes prevent some of these people from speaking. Oh, they're just hateful, and they're spewing hate. They shouldn't be on our campus. Well, don't you believe in the free expression of ideas? Well, I do, but not those ideas. Oh, okay. Do you? And you see this all the time. When Ben Shapiro came up to UConn about a year ago and all these other people speaking on campuses. Heck, they started fires, I think, when Ann Coulter or Shapiro was supposed to be at Cal Berkeley. But then on the other side, you know, if a liberal speaker comes on, do you ever? Now, maybe it's happened. I don't know. Do you ever see, to any great extent, conservative students trying to stop a liberal from speaking? Doesn't really happen. And that's therein lies the problem today. You're only allowed to say things on campus or in these settings if they fit these speech codes. I remember being in college late 70s, early 80s, as much of it a blur as it is now. And I went to Boston U. I went to BU. And we'd have speakers every week. And one week there'd be, you know, somebody from the far right, John Birch Society guy. And then the next week we'd have somebody from, like, the American Communist Party. Nobody cared. Nobody picketed. Nobody set fires and everything. If this person interested you, you went there. And some people went there and they were cheering, hey, everything, down with America, hey, all right, up with Cuba, hey. And if you agreed, fine. If you didn't, you know. And if you didn't, there was a question and answer period where the speakers, left or right, they invited questions. That's what it's for. But today, good Lord, you know, you only want to hear voices that you agree with? What's that about? That's like, you know what that's like? It's like going to the batting cage. And you know how they have the three, you know, most batting cages have three speeds, you know, like 50 miles an hour, 70 miles an hour, 90 miles an hour. It's like, oh, I'm ripping the cover off the ball today. I'm ripping it. Yeah, but you're only in a 50-mile-an-hour machine. Well, that's all I want to be. Okay, so you're living in your own universe. In your universe, you're Reggie Jackson. You're Mookie Betts, you know, on the Little League speed. Well, that's what I want to be. Okay. Chanley to join us here. We bring Rich on to talk about things journalism and sports-wise as well. Rich, good to hear you again. Happy New Year. How are you?
Happy New Year, Paul. Good to hear you.
Well, geez, you know, it's a mutual admiration society here. I'm liking
that. Yeah, here we go. Because we're both Rangers fans.
Yes. Hey, camp is open, baby. That's all I care about.
That's right. They opened up today.
That's right. Let's just say, you know, whatever it is, 56 games, I'll take it. Over the weekend, Rich, somebody died. And if you Google, as I did, something to the effect of greatest ever Connecticut athletes, this gentleman is in the top 10. He's in a lot of top fives. And a lot of people remember the name. A lot of people in the younger generation may not know who he was, but we're talking, of course, of Floyd Little of New Haven. He died after a long battle with an illness. But, Rich, I know you, following college football and how that relates to America and in the pro ranks, you had some thoughts about his impact, not only in the sport, but for the state of Connecticut and the southern Connecticut area as well.
Floyd Little of New Haven was a great football player. He's on the Mount Rushmore of Syracuse running backs with Jimmy Brown, Ernie Davis. There's Floyd Little and Larry Zonka. He's a College Football Hall of Fame, Pro Football Hall of Fame member. Just a really, really, really good football player. And folks who play football know there are two kinds. There are guys who play football, and there are football players. And he was a football player, thoroughly in the game as a running back, and certainly one of Connecticut's top athletes ever, certainly top 10. Argument can be made top 5. An argument can be made the best athlete. He's in two Hall of Fames. Many residents can say that. Not many people can say that at any rate. So he he certainly exemplified, what a running back would be, in the 1960s and 1970s. Hard-nosed, get the hard yard when you need it, but also able to spring through a hole, and get big yardage if necessary.
And he came out of New Haven, and his name is still on a few things in the New Haven area, Fieldhouse, to name one. Rich, he came out of New Haven at a time in the 60s where pro football was not exactly like it is today, where, 70 to 75% of the league is African-American. The NFL wasn't really, at least the NFL, the AFL was different, but the NFL wasn't really what you would call progressive when it came to race issues at the time that Floyd Little came up.
No, and Floyd Little started with the Denver Broncos in 1967. It's only 5 years removed from when the Washington football team signed its first African-American player in 1962. So it was still a largely white game in both the AFL and the NFL. Certainly black Americans were making inroads. More and more colleges were desegregating, in the South, but a process that didn't end until 1972. In fact, in 1969, two all-white teams played for what would have been the national championship, Texas and Arkansas. Floyd Little by then was in his third year in the NFL. So he's certainly a pioneer in the aspect of racial relations, and he certainly, exemplified all, that was good about football, during that period, which was, character builder, unifier, and so on and so forth. And that's something he carried through the rest of his life. He was always, always willing to help mentor young athletes, always willing to speak at a banquet and give words of advice to young people about how to, bear down and concentrate and succeed and to sacrifice to succeed, take those sorts of messages out to the community. And he will be missed, and the fact that he is a legend in three separate cities, I think, speaks to him not only as an athlete but as a person. That's New Haven, Syracuse, and Denver, Colorado.
Rich, hang on. We'll be back to you. Talk a little college football with Rich Hanley, who teaches a course on college football at Quinnipiac. When we come back, Rich, hang on, we will talk to Rich about the fact that there was actually a college football season this year. It's got one big title game left to go, and one time I talked to Rich several months ago, and there was a notion that there may be no college football at all during COVID-19. And a lot of people were saying, you just can't have that. You've got to have games, and they did, and got almost a full season in. More straight ahead, traffic and weather together, 3:36 on WICC. Yeah, that's us. A few more minutes here with Professor Rich Hanley, Quinnipiac University. Teaches in the communications school there, but he teaches a course on the history and relevance of football in America, college football, too. And, Rich, I remember when you and I talked a few months back, we're like, oh, boy, well, Yale canceled and UConn canceled, so will there be any college football around the country? And a lot of people at the time said, what's the big deal? It's only a game. You, obviously, with your teaching on it, tend to differ with that. And I think, Rich, the NCAA and all the conferences, it wasn't perfect, but here we are with one game left. They got almost a full season in.
They did. The football bowl subdivision did. The football championship subdivision, which used to be Division I AA, mid-major type colleges, like Sacred Heart, didn't play. Division II didn't play, and Division III didn't play.
Yeah.
So most of the 700 colleges that field teams didn't play. But the Power Five conferences and the Group of Five conferences, which constitute the teams that compete in bowls that we see on TV and compete in the national championship, did play, and it was uneven. A lot of games were canceled. Ohio State played only six games, heading into the semifinals.
Yeah,
the
but
other
they looked pretty good the other night.
they looked rested, yeah. Ready to play football. They did. Yeah, that team is really good. There's no question about that. Alabama is a powerhouse as always.
Alabama's an NFL team.
Remarkable how the coach Nick Saban can recruit the depth of athlete that he can. It's a really, really sound football team. And one thing about the game between Alabama and Notre Dame that I think should be noted is that the retired college referee who advises in the booth, you know, the commentators and the play-by-play person, said it was always a joy to work Notre Dame and Alabama games because he said the players really, really focused on the play. They weren't focused on trash talking. They weren't focused on, you know, the pushing and shoving that goes on between plays. The whistle blew. They went back to the huddle. They went back to the line. He said it was a joy to do those games because the concentration was only on the game from the players' perspective. And I think that shows the maturity of the players that are recruited at both schools and also the maturity of the coaches and the type of players they recruit.
And, Rich, now hopefully we're kind of maybe getting to some light at the end of the tunnel here with maybe this second wave easing off in a month or two. The vaccines are coming. You know, I think, Rich, levels of sport from professional down to some colleges, you know, I think it was good and necessary that they played and are playing. The NBA is starting up. The NHL is starting up. You know, America needs this for its psyche. We need to be able to go home at night, kick off our shoes, grab a beer, whatever, and just turn a game on and turn life off for a little while.
You know, it was important. I know there's no doubt that, you know, in certain regions of the country, football is life. Basketball is life. And without those games, it had, quite frankly, a disorienting effect on millions of people. And the fact that the NBA was able to play, the NHL was able to play, the WNBA was able to play, you know, the NFL was able to play, and, you know, and the FBS schools, for the most part, were able to play. Mm-hmm. You know, I think helped America's psyche. And as you say, Paul, you know, and kind of turning off the drumbeat of COVID-19 and the political atmosphere in which we are, you know, existing, and kind of got them looking at, okay, this is backstage for us. We can actually relax, watch a game, talk sports, and kind of turn our attention, at least momentarily, away from the travails of the age.
And now, Rich, I guess the last chapter here of this, looking ahead, you know, months on, and, you know, rear ends in the seats, that's cash flow for a lot of these pro teams. And they're going to try to start doing this, Rich, you know, as early as possible. Because, look, as I was saying to somebody here in the building, when you see the New York Yankees hesitating on contract offers, you know, because there was nobody in the stands last year and maybe at least half the season this year, you know how much this pandemic has affected sports.
Oh, sure. And I, you know, I think of the parking lot attendant, the person who has a job selling beer and hot dogs in the stands, the concession workers. You know, the sports is an enormous business in the United States. And it's not just the athletes and the owners who are making money. There's just a lot of people. It may not be their primary employment, but it does serve as a second job. And for many, it is their primary employment, the stadium employees, and so on and so forth. So, I mean, without sports, we'd be taking a significant chunk out of the American economy. And at the individual level, taking away livelihoods. You know, now I'm not saying it wasn't necessary, but it does take the livelihoods away from people who depend on the revenue. Even folks, who live on Chapel Street in New Haven, and let cars park in their front yard during Yale games. Okay, that's $100. You know, for 5 weeks, that's $500. You know that. Well, for some folks, that's meaningful, and to not have that capacity to earn that extra money, you know, has an impact on lives. So it'll be good to get everybody back, good to get fans back into the stands, and most of all, good to get those stadium and arena employees back doing the job that they love to do.
Professor Rich Hanley, Quinnipiac University. Rich, a happy new year. Always good to talk to you. We'll talk, buddy. Be good.
Thank you, Paul. Good to talk to you.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
We'll be joining us in just a few minutes. She's busy voting. And I'll give you just a brief update before Rosa comes on and gives you an update of what's going on in Congress in terms of the COVID relief money and things going forward. Let me just show you these numbers in brief. This is just a couple of days worth of numbers. I think what's of interest there is the positivity rate, relatively stable at 5.29%. I say relatively, as I've said before, don't be a day trader. You probably remember on the 30th and 31st, we spiked up to 9%. We felt pretty unhappy about that. We've come back down again. Our seven-day average is a little more than 5.3%. It's 6.6% because of some of those numbers. But it's worth remembering that even at 6.6%, we are probably the sixth lowest state in the country, thanks to you. Thanks for you being erring on the side of caution. And it's tough. I'm looking at New York, which is flared up. I think they're at 7.5 plus. Massachusetts, over 8%. Rhode Island, over 8%. So our neighbors, their seven-day averages are still a little bit more, which, as I've said before, we're not an island unto ourselves. That's why these numbers are worth watching. But so far now, more than a week since Christmas, we've still got relative stability there, still have good capacity in our hospitals. That number has not really gone up in the last 6-8 weeks. So I think steady as she goes in terms of those metrics. The new metrics, which we like to pay a little more attention to these days, more on the positive front, is the vaccine update. And we've got, through a lot of good pre-planning, working closely with our hospitals, working closely with CVS and Walgreens, planning for this. We're one of the first states in the country to get over 2% of our population with at least their first vaccine dose. And that is something we are following carefully, and I'll tell you how we're able to get those positive numbers. You can see the other states that join us, those with most likely to get north of 2% population is West Virginia, Montana, North Dakota, Maine, all of which are sort of small population states. For us, it's a little more complicated. It's a very dense state with a lot of people. We have to be very thoughtful about how you roll out the vaccine, get people notified, and make sure they can do it on a timely basis. And to date, working with hospitals and working with nursing homes, we've had pretty good success. And I thank our friends at Public Health for their efforts there. The update more broadly, we've administered about 75,000 doses. We've received about 167,000. So we're on par per capita compared to our peers in terms of the doses coming in. And we've done pretty well in doses administered. By the end of this week, by Friday, Josh feels very confident we'll have 100% of our nursing homes, that's patients and all the nurses that we can get to take the vaccine, will have had their first vaccination. That's an amazing first start. Second doses, just to jump ahead there, start today for other people. So we're now beginning to catch up and complete what we had always anticipated doing for those first-tier responders. Soon, like today, we're going to be moving into the assisted living facilities, again, because those are people that are most likely to suffer complications, be that sometimes fatalities, sometimes going to the ICU or the hospitals. Very important we take care of folks there. 85 sites are now administering vaccines, and that's obviously hospitals. That's at the nursing homes. We're rolling that out to pharmacies over the next couple of weeks. So as we broaden our population, it'll be easier for people to get their vaccine on a retail basis right at their local pharmacy, Walgreens, CVS, you name it, public health, federally qualified health centers. One of the things we're working on very hard to make sure doesn't happen in Connecticut, what you see happening in some other places, is a supply and demand disconnect. And you see sometimes the vaccines are sitting on the shelf and not being used and collecting dust. We're not letting that happen. With just-in-time inventory, we're being very careful. And if a hospital, we give a call, find out they have some extra vaccines, looks like they're not going to be used by the end of the day, we move that to somebody else in need. So we're going to leverage this as best we can. For updates all along the way, ct.gov/COVID vaccine, ct.gov/COVID vaccine. That will give you updates on where the vaccinations are taking place alongside testing. A lot of our hospitals are going to co-locate vaccinations and testing. give you some confidence of where those places are. What is coming next? Well, I think as early as tomorrow, our allocation committee will be meeting. Allocation committee is the group that I'm working closely with CDC, the Centers for Disease Control down there in Washington, D.C., are going to allocate who comes after these first-line healthcare folks in the nursing homes and the hospitals. And we should be rolling that out over the next 2 to 3 weeks for the first step. And how we prioritize those essential workers, these are folks who can't telecommute, have to interface with people every day. That's what I'll be listening to for from the allocation committee. They're going to be creating the process. Again, you'll be able to get that information at the website. Not like what you see here in Florida, which is you've probably been seeing some of the newspaper TV clips on this. They sort of opened the doors. People waited in line for 8 hours. They ran out of vaccine after 4 or 5 hours. People left, came back the next day. We're going to do this online. And if you don't have online, make a phone reservation. Make sure the right people are getting the vaccine at the time that they've scheduled. And I think that will hopefully make sure that we've got the best group of people getting the vaccine on a timely basis. If we find we do have additional vaccine, we'll continue to open up the lens a little bit more, either in terms of age groups, demographics, or other frontline responders, to make sure that every drop of that vaccine is administered on a timely basis. I don't want to leave anything to chance, and I don't want to leave anybody behind. And we'll give you more guidance over the course of the next couple of weeks on that. One last thing before I introduce Rosa. Today, kids are beginning to go back to school. And some are going back this week. Some are going to wait a week. Many are picking up where they left off in December. And I just want you to see something that was highlighted to me, something that Miguel Cardona reminds me all the time, is you can see the red bar. Those are kids who go to school in person. The blue are the remote days. And you can see that you're much more likely to be learning in classroom than you are not in classroom. You can see that that disconnect, you can see the achievement gap is widened. More likely kids are left behind if they're students with disabilities. There you can see the blue, those that are remote learning, 85%. Those that are in-person students with disabilities, 92%. Those with free and discounted meals, 86% if you're remote or logged in, meaning 14% aren't logging in, not getting that education, compared to 92%. It does make an enormous difference. And that's why President Biden was quite forceful in saying one of the reasons he wanted Miguel Cardona, as Secretary of Education, do what we can to get kids back in the classroom. That said, we waited a long time, Rosa, for the CARES Act money. You had it passed down in the House of Representatives many months ago, and we are so appreciative the money came in, including a lot of money so kids can stay in school, remote learn, or be in classrooms safely. And I just want to say, you know, on a personal note, Rosa, you've been a great friend for me, a great friend for the state of Connecticut for an awful long time, and I could not be prouder on behalf of the people of Connecticut, and I'd say across the country, that you're our chairperson of appropriations. That is a big deal. That's a big deal for Connecticut and Connecticut values in terms of how we allocate federal resources over the course of the next couple years and beyond. And Rosa's on the front lines there. And Rosa, I'd just love you to talk a little bit about the CARES Act, what has taken place, what we can expect over the next few months.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you so much, Governor. It's a pleasure and honor to join with you. I thank you for the invitation. And I can see on the screen Josh Jabal and Paul Mounds, and hello to the two of you as well. And I thank you for your kind remarks, Governor. But most of all, we thank you for your leadership during what is an unprecedented time in our state and in our country. So listen, I am so honored to be a chair of the Appropriations Committee. And you know that we've already spoken. I said we would get together with you and with your team about What are the most important priorities for the state of Connecticut? How do we strengthen Connecticut's economy? And what are going to be the kinds of investments that are necessary for the future of our state? And I know you are waging a very important fight against the virus. And thank you for the compliment, because we do stand shoulder to shoulder in trying to deal with this fight. The bill that was before us with the CARES Act, look, we secured critical help, I believe, for the state and for the people of Connecticut. You also know that this is not the bill that the Democrats fought for, but I believe we have critical help that has been passed in this piece of legislation. It's an important first step forward as we think about where we go from here. We fought for, as you know, the additional 1,400 direct payments to ensure that individual received a total of $2,000, but that did not come to pass. And I'm of the Shirley Chisholm mode that you don't stand on the sidelines, you know, wringing your hands and complaining, but we move forward with implementing, you know, what we have before us. We secured, as I said, this critical help. Each member of Congress may represent a vastly different district with unique challenges, but the effort was to halt the suffering. Those who have lost loved ones to the virus, stop the spread of the pandemic, provide a pathway to economic recovery, and deliver results for hardworking families. There's a new $600 tax credit that each taxpayer will receive, brings temporary relief to struggling Americans. A family of four would get about $2,400. Married couple can now receive $1,200, while a family of four with two children will get that additional $1,200 and or an additional $600 for each qualifying child. And in Connecticut, the CDC estimates that Connecticut should receive about $46 million in vaccine distribution funding and $205 million in testing and tracing of funding. This is a start to additional funding. I believe that one of the first undertakings of the president-elect is that he will come to the Congress and ask for additional funding to speed up vaccine production and distribution. You know, it will be my goal and have every intention of ensuring that the funding will be there for that effort. So we secured some help in some other areas as well. All unemployment insurance UI programs have been extended to March 14th, extending the Pandemic Unemployment Assistance, the PUA, and the Pandemic Emergency Unemployment Compensation, PEUC, by almost 3 months. That provides our workers in Connecticut with nearly $2 billion to maintain the paid leave option, restores the enhanced federal unemployment insurance bump that provides an additional $300 per week for all workers who are receiving unemployment benefits. Small businesses in Connecticut are finally getting additional help that they deserve. The Wall Street Journal reported that about one in three small businesses have closed their doors in Connecticut as a result of the pandemic. This is devastating for Connecticut's families and for our economy, which is why we were looking to a second round of the PPP loans. The new funding has dedicated $284 billion for very small businesses using community-based lenders and makes changes to support the smallest businesses, struggling nonprofits, and independent restaurants. If you need assistance, you can utilize a federally funded small business loan specialist at the Connecticut Small Business Development Center or the Women's Business Development Center. On several other fronts, we have our families who are struggling. We've seen the hunger lines in Connecticut, people lined up to get food. So hunger has skyrocketed during the pandemic. Families are being evicted from their homes as well. And much of this burden has fallen on local and state communities. We need to do more by making sure that heroes in our state and local government who are experiencing a budget shortfall, as only you can testify to, that what our concern is deterioration over the next several months. We need to have a strong and robust funding for state and local government so that we are not losing police, fire, teachers, and others, because our communities cannot lose essential services. We need to take a look at education, and we are also proud of Connecticut and Miguel Cardona being the nominee for Secretary of Education. We know what great job he has done in our state. The relief includes funding for our schools in Connecticut through a stabilization fund framework, that was included in the CARES Act earlier last year. Connecticut should receive for K through 12, $494 million for K through 12, for higher education, $225 million. There's a lot in the package that entails specific rules, requires different processes to access the help. So the public should feel free to call my office for any questions or for any assistance. Those will be the priorities that guide the appropriations process as we start the new term. What we want to try to do, and we also passed at this time an appropriations package for 2021, and that information will be forthcoming to all of you. What we're trying to do is to make sure, because this happened so late, that we can break down the numbers so we know specifically the dollar amounts that we are getting in Connecticut. I might add, with regard to the funding for food assistance, we increased the food stamp of budget by about 15%. About $13 billion in emergency food assistance. The issue again is, as we continue to speak, I will try to get the numbers on a much more granular basis so that you know, and you, Josh, and Paul know what is the specific dollar amounts that are going to Connecticut. I will just add this one more point. Governor, with regard to the education money, there is the 492 for K through 12. The governor's fund is $28.1 million, and the higher ed, as I said, is $225 million. Some of this funding goes by formula basis. Some of it will go directly to the districts in education. And we have to go, and I'm happy we will sit down, my staff will sit down with your staff and really try to go line by line as to which pot of money goes in which direction and where it is housed.